James Dean is the eternal youthful rebel, rejected, sincere, arrogant, sensitive, feared, confused, unloved.
You're tearing me apart!
Violent, lonesome, uncontrollable, moody, and tormented.
You look a certain way, you can't...
That's right, you're absolutely...
Look,
you're absolutely right.
You're not listening to me!
He was the definitive movie idol. A live-fast, die-young outsider, blessed with the looks, the style, the talent, and the attitude that captivated a generation.
Watching him act, I've never in my life seen anybody as good an actor as he was.
Me, I'm gonna have more money than you ever thought you could have. You and all the rest of you stinking sons of Benedicts.
Everything was perfect. The face, the smile, movements of the body, and the acting, the charm, the voice.
I have never done anything right. I've been going around with my head in a sling for years.
It was like we were brothers in a second. It was just, I liked the guy, and he liked me, and that was that.
He died young, achieving cult status and becoming an icon of American culture.
I said, if you get into that car by 10 o'clock at night next Thursday, you'll be dead. And he was dead the following Thursday afternoon in that car.
When he died at the wheel of his silver Porsche Spyder 50 years ago, his image of rebellious youth was frozen forever.
The reason that he became so iconoclastic is that he was a rebel, and that's what we thought all of us ought to be if you were a teenager.
I gotta know who I am. I gotta know what I'm like.
James Dean was just a sort of image inspiration. This sort of moody character. Did he look cool?
Elvis's rebellion and ours did it via music, whereas Brando and James Dean were doing it on the big screen.
Yet his influence extended far beyond just the image on a movie screen. James Dean represented freedom. He inspired a generation of teenagers to break out of their suburban normality and think for themselves.
All of us were touched by Jimmy, and that he was touched by greatness.
I'm Johnny Depp, and this is the story of James Dean. The son of a dental technician, James Byron Dean was born February 8, 1931, in Marion, Indiana, a small, economically depressed Midwest town 70 miles from Indianapolis. When he was five, his family moved to California. His mother encouraged his artistic side, and he learned tap dancing and violin. When he was nine, his mother died of cancer. His father decided Jimmy would be better off living with his relatives back in Indiana, so he arranged for his mother's coffin to be sent back to Marion for the funeral. Jimmy returned on the same train. He lived with his uncle Marcus and aunt Hortense. His cousin is Marcus Winslow Jr.
His dad was in a bad way financially, and also he didn't have anyone to help him look after Jimmy, and my mom offered to take Jimmy. I think probably at the time they didn't know if it was temporary or permanent. We all felt like he was a very ordinary boy. Of course, he came to live with my parents after the death of his mother, and Jimmy was 9 years old then, and I wasn't born until 3 years later, so my memories of him is just like an older brother being around. I've heard my sister talk about him quite a bit, and she tells the stories about when she'd have a girlfriend over to visit her or something, why they'd go upstairs in her room, and Jimmy would sneak upstairs. She could hear the stairway squeaking, and she'd holler down and tell my mom, tell Jimmy to get back downstairs, and he would, but then she said it wasn't very long, he'd be right back up there again.
His uncle Marcus was a Quaker minister who taught Jimmy to love car racing and classical music, especially Bartok and Stravinsky.
The poor bastard, everything he loved, he lost.
Michael J. Sheridan, director of James Dean, Forever Young.
Obviously, his mother died when he was nine. 3 days later, his father gave him up for all intents and purposes, so he lost both parents within 3 days. He loved the people that raised him, but as he grew up on the farm, he was involved with a 4-H club, and he raised a little pet goat. And he came home from school one day, and they sat down, and they were having dinner, and his uncle Marcus Sr. said, "How's your dinner?" He said, "All right." He said, "Well, you should enjoy it because it's Billy." It was his pet goat that they had slaughtered for dinner. Jimmy ran away for a week. They couldn't find him anywhere. And I confronted Marcus Jr. and I said, is that true? And he sort of chuckled and he said, yeah, that was my father.
I'm sure that he missed his mother after she died, and he probably missed his father some, but my folks said they never heard a word from him that, you know, it was bothering him or anything, and I think he adjusted very well. He considered them probably his main parents by the time he got out of high school.
Jimmy was nearsighted and wore very thick glasses, even when excelling at sports. His other passions were art and drama, and he spent his high school years as a prominent member of the drama club.
My mom was kind of artistic. She liked to paint, and Jimmy's dad was kind of an artist. He'd sketch and draw things, and Jimmy just kind of picked it up. I think Jimmy's mother, before she passed away, she was very close to Jimmy, and they had a little puppet set they used to play with, and they'd kind of do little plays with these puppets. And so, you know, I think some of it was a talent that he probably inherited.
After graduating from high school, Jimmy returned to California to live with his father. He enrolled in a pre-law program before switching to a performance arts course in 1950. That was the year he saw a film called The Men, which featured the film debut of Marlon Brando. Dean was deeply affected by Brando's performance in The Men and decided to devote all his energies to becoming a method actor. With encouragement from James Whitmore, Jimmy headed to New York to try his luck on Broadway. He auditioned for the Actors Studio and became one of the youngest students to be accepted. But he was more interested in having a good time and took bongo lessons from percussionist Cyril Jackson, learned photography with Roy Schat, and went to dancing lessons with Eartha Kitt. While working various jobs and auditioning for off-Broadway productions, Jimmy became friends with another struggling young actor, Martin Landau.
I came in and I sat down with my number, and there was this guy sitting next to me with glasses, and I'd never seen him before. He just arrived in New York. So I said, what's your name? He said, Jim. What's yours, Marty? I said, first time here? And he said, yeah. You? I said, my last. And that was literally the first conversation we had. We went up there, and they looked us over, and they said, thank you very much, and we walked out. And we went into the drugstore and had some coffee. Up until this time, I hadn't talked to him that much. We were busy playing. When we sat down in Cromwell's, that was really our first conversation. That's when he told me he'd been in California, and he went to UCLA, and he worked with Jimmy Whitmore. And this is winter of 1953. We exchanged phone numbers, and within a day or two, I got a call from him. He said, what are you doing? I said, I don't know. What the hell are you doing?
He decided to go to New York because at that time, the TV work was all in New York. Did a couple Broadway plays and approximately 40 television shows. A lot of people, I think, had the feeling that he was just an overnight success, but he wasn't. He really struggled and worked hard.
There were some flat rocks in Central Park, not too far from the zoo, and we would sit there and solve the problems of the world and watch the girls go by. We talk about Marlon, we talk about the future, we talk about acting techniques. The 50s in New York were an exciting time. There was a great sense of camaraderie and rivalry, and theater was happening, Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams, and all of this stuff was going on, and it was all centered around the Actors Studio.
After 3 years of small roles on stage and screen, Jimmy got his big break when director Elia Kazan caught Jimmy's performance as an Arabian gigolo in a play called The Immoralist. Kazan had directed Marlon Brando in both A Streetcar Named Desire and the classic On the Waterfront. He was considering Brando and another screen idol, Montgomery Clift, for the lead roles in his screen version of John Steinbeck's East of Eden, a retelling of the biblical tale of Cain and Abel, set in California in the early 20s. Brando and Clift couldn't agree which brother they would play, so Kazan decided to use unknown actors instead. Once he met Dean, Kazan decided Jimmy was ideal for the part.
I called him into the Warner Brother office, and he came there, And he just sat there looking rather surly and unresponsive. Then he finally said to me, do you want to ride on my bike? So I said, yeah, I'll take a ride on your bike. So I got in the back of his bike and he went around the city in the goddamn bike. And I wish I'd never met him. But as I got to talking to him more and more and more, I said, this guy's it. And I called Steinbeck up. I said, I'll tell you, I found a guy that may not be a great actor, but he is it. I said, is that important? He says, if he's it, send him up. So I sent him up to John. And John said, I don't like the guy, but he's it. He said, he's the guy.
Kazan also auditioned another young actor, Paul Newman, for the part of Cal's brother Aaron, but instead chose Richard Davalos. For the female lead, Kazan cast Julie Harris.
He just reminded me from the very beginning of Tom Sawyer, a guy who would always get you to paint the fence and get you into the terrible scrapes. But it was all like, well, what's life for? It's not to just go plodding in the same places every day, but it's an adventure. I thought he was absolutely mesmerizing. I thought his performance was so beautiful and had such variety to it.
Leonard Rosenman composed the score for East of Eden and was James Dean's first flatmate in New York.
I think that this kind of runaway, the leather-jacketed man running from society, which was the figure of that time, you know, which was a kind of middle-class version of The Wild Ones, which Brando had done several years back, was the kind of thing that Jimmy was compelled to do in some way, but at the same time, there was a side of him that didn't want to do it, and that's why, of course, he went into analysis toward the end of his life, as he really seeked to avoid that.
Jimmy had great curiosity as a young man.
Martin Landau.
That's one of the things that bonded us in a way. And oddly, one would kind of think that Jimmy was a cynic, but he wasn't. You know, I mean, a lot of people, in retrospect, say Jimmy probably had a death wish. I don't believe that at all. You know, you hear people say, well, it was inevitable and he wanted to die. That is not the case.
Once the cast had been confirmed, they flew to L.A. to begin filming. Jimmy carried all his belongings in two brown paper bags. Kazan encouraged friction between Dean and his co-star Raymond Massey as he sought to bring out the repressed memory of Jimmy's lost mother and distant father to give emotional force to the scenes.
My mother, she's not dead and gone to heaven, is she?
Why do you ask that?
She's not dead at all.
George Perry, author of the new James Dean biography.
She's alive.
There is a scene in East of Eden in which James Dean tries to win his father's love by giving him back the money that he's lost on some speculative venture. And his father rejects it on the grounds that the money, in his view, hasn't been acquired legitimately. And the rejection is so painful that James Dean absolutely breaks down on the set.
What is this?
It's all the money you lost on the lettuce.
You made it?
Yeah.
But how?
Beans.
Beans?
We bought futures at 5 cents, and war came along, and the price went sky high.
Cal, you will have to give it back.
No, I made it for you, Dad.
You'll have to give it back.
Who?
To the people you got it from.
British Purchasing Agency? I can't give it back to them.
Then give it to the farmers you robbed.
We didn't rob anybody, Dad. We paid 2 cents a pound, 2 cents over market for that stuff.
Cal, I sign my name, and boys go out, and some die, and some live helpless without arms and legs. Not one will come back untorn. Do you think I could take a profit from that?
Raymond Massey, who was playing the father, was absolutely unprepared for this tremendous onslaught, but being a great pro, he stayed in character. And of course, Kazan let the scene roll. And it's one of the most powerful things in movies. And a lot of people who saw that thought, this is such an amazing performance from a young man. He can't be acting, it's got to be real.
Elia Kazan.
But what I photographed was their relationship to each other, the absolute hatred that Ray Massey felt for Jimmy Dean and the hatred Jimmy Dean felt for Ray Massey. That's precious, man. You can't get that. No director can get that. You hopefully arouse it. You're essentially awakening something that's there by some tactic or other, some means or other, by some hint or other, by some stimulus or other.
During the filming of East of Eden, director Elia Kazan arranged for Jimmy's hero, Marlon Brando, to visit the set. Dean idolized Brando and was nervous in his company. They met several times over the years, and Brando apparently enjoyed teasing the younger star. The late Sammy Davis Jr. on a TV special in 1974 recalled an occasion when Jimmy invited himself to a party with Marlon Brando.
I talked Jimmy into coming to a party that Ella Logan was giving for me in the Valley. And she said, gee, I've invited all your friends and all your buddies, and you know what, I've invited Marlon Brando. Do you know him? I said, yes, I know him from New York. So I'm telling Jimmy about this that night, and he says, can I come? And I said, of course you can, man. And he said, all right, I'll be there. And he wore Marlon's complete, you know, the wild one, wore the whole outfit, came in on the motorcycle, walked in with the leather jacket, the boots, everything, and Marlon arrived in a suit and a tie. And Jimmy went, he tricked me, man. He really tricked me. And it was so funny because that night they hung out and talked, and I remember asking about a year later, have you seen Marlon recently? He says, no, man. He's on the lot, but he won't even speak to me.
Martin Landau.
Marlon and Jimmy met a few times, and there was no question that there was a degree of rivalry, but it was natural. But they really couldn't play the same roles. I mean, if you really looked at it, just in terms of age, even though there wasn't that much difference between their ages, but you thought of Marlon as older and Jimmy as younger.
George Perry.
Jimmy had a different approach from Marlon Brando, actually. He does things that Marlon never did. He has a vulnerability that isn't there with Brando. And I think this is one of the reasons why his appeal has gone on lasting. Women always found that they wanted to protect him. You know, there's something so damaged and demanding care and love. And Jimmy sort of could project this in a superb way.
Marlon was the same thing in a man, and Monty Clift was the same thing in a softer man, and Jimmy was the same thing in a boy, and the first one, and every boy in America could identify with it. When it's visceral, and when you say, I know that, I feel that, I am that, I mean, wow. And I understood that at the time. I said, wow, I mean, he's going to be a major movie star.
Dennis Hopper.
He admired Brando and Cliff very much as actors. And he said, the reason that I'm going to make it is because I've got Marlon Brando on this hand saying, screw you. And I've got Montgomery Clift in this hand saying, help me. And somewhere in between is James Dean.
Once work on East of Eden was finished, Jimmy went back to his family's home in Indiana with his photographer friend Dennis Stock to shoot a series of photographs. One of the most memorable shots is of Jimmy sitting in a coffin, an image that has often been reproduced to support a common perception that Jimmy had a death wish. Dennis Stock explains how the photo came about.
I didn't like the circumstance of how that happened. That was the only time I got spooked in Fairmount, where he got dressed, put on this white scarf, and we walked to a shop that first appeared as a furniture shop. He said, I want to show you something. And we went into the furniture shop, made a left turn, and ended up in a room full of coffins. And he jumped into one. And he started making these very infantile expressions. And I hated it. I said, what the hell are you doing? Oh, take my picture, take my picture. And so I indulged him in it with great reluctance. And just at the very end, I made my summation of what I experienced with the sitting up at the lost boy sitting in a coffin, yeah? And a few months later, he died.
The critics raved about Dean's performance in East of Eden, and the movie became a hit. Jimmy's portrayal of Cal, a hell-raising teenager who yearned to be loved and accepted by his stern, deeply religious father, struck a chord with teenagers far more eloquently than any previous actor. David Putnam.
I didn't meet my father till I was 5 because he was away in the war, and I was absolutely devoted to him. And by the time 1955, 56 rolled around and I was 15, it was getting a complicated relationship, and I was going through a lot of changes. And East of Eden helped me enormously because it both justified the confusion I was going through, but it also had the catharsis of the ending, which allowed me to feel it was fine to still adore my dad.
You used to say that was where you...
And I remember the first time I saw the film, and in fact, ever since, absolutely crying my eyes out at the final scene when the father's had the stroke in bed, when he shouts at the nurse.
See, I do remember.
Look, I can't find any coffee.
Get out!
Yes.
It summed up exactly my journey and where I hoped to arrive, which is to be absolutely reconciled with and be able to convey to my father how much I admired and loved him.
What did he say? He said, don't get anybody else. He said, you stay with me. You take care of me.
Oh. Alan Parker.
The great artistic work is East of Eden, without a doubt, which I think is pretty great. The reason that he became so iconoclastic, whatever the word is that the first one was classic teenage thing. It was a rebel, and that's what we thought all of us ought to be if you were a teenager.
Martin Landau.
Jimmy had a sense that things were going to change for him. But it didn't change him a lot. It just made him aware that things were happening. There was almost a kinesthetic response to stuff. In terms of his fame, he experienced some of it.
Jimmy always said that he was going to be a star someday.
James Dean's cousin, Marcus Winslow Jr.
I'll never forget, he bought a motorcycle one time in California, and the guy told me himself, he said, before Jimmy rode it away from the shop, why, East of Eden hadn't been released yet, apparently, and Jimmy told the fellow, he said, if you want to come out here and take some pictures of me on this motorcycle, he said, you're welcome to, because he said, I'm going to be famous someday, and the guy just kind of laughed it off and said, boy, that's the biggest mistake I ever made in my life. I think Jimmy, he had a lot of confidence in himself, and I think that he was pretty determined that he was going to go to the top, and he was also going to do it just as fast as he could.
Dennis Stock.
East of Eden premiered in New York City. In fact, I photographed him in front of the marquee with Eartha Kitt, and he looked slovenly. He looked like hell. He didn't look like the star of a successful Hollywood film, you know. It didn't affect him.
Jimmy celebrated the film's success by buying his first Porsche racing car and entering his first road race. The following week, he started work on Nicholas Ray's movie about middle-class delinquents in L.A. Rebel Without a Cause was to become a classic.
I think that you can't just go around proving things and pretending like you're tough.
You
can't, even though you got you look a certain way, you can't.
That's right. You're absolutely.
You're absolutely
right.
You're not listening to me. You're involved in this just like I am.
You can't be idealistic all your life, Jim. Nobody, thanks you for sticking your neck out.
Except for yourself.
The movie featured early performances from three other young Hollywood stars: Sal Mineo, Natalie Wood, and Dennis Hopper.
The first time I saw him, he was walking down a hallway, Warner Brothers, and he had about a week's growth of beard, and he was hanging a cigarette out of his mouth, and very thick glasses on, and my agent said, that's James Dean. And I said, that's James Dean. On East of Eden, Kazan had the whole crew and cast line up outside the soundstage. Kazan said, you're going to meet a boy, and he's going to be very strange to you, and he's going to be different, but no matter what you see or what you think of him, when you see him on the screen, he's going to be pure gold. Then he said, I want you to meet James Dean. And they opened the soundstage door, and James Dean came out and went, F*** you. And Raymond Massey was standing there, a very religious man who doesn't like any kind of cussing on the set. He turned to Kazan and he said, what price is gold?
George Perry.
The set of Rebel Without a Cause was absolutely throbbing with all kinds of liaisons and tensions. Nicholas Ray is actually having an affair with Natalie Wood, who was only a teenager. To complicate matters, she was also Dennis Hopper's girlfriend. So Dennis was extremely angry over it all, and he was relegated to a lesser role because of that anger. Then Sal Mineo was besotted by James Dean and totally unrequited. It was a very extraordinary affair.
Sal Mineo.
I was to read for Nick Ray, and I went to Nick's hotel, and he introduced me to Jimmy. It was on a Sunday afternoon. And he said, I'd just like to go over a couple of scenes. So I started reading the scene with Jimmy. And then Nick said, now let's put the script away. And he said, can you do improvisations? And of course I said, yes. You know, I mean, I wanted that role very badly. I had no idea what he was talking about. And I picked it up from Jimmy. I realized that Jimmy was doing the scene, but he was using different dialogue. And I realized that that's what improvisations are, that you just don't do the dialogue that's written. You make up your own dialogue. And so we improvised the sequence.
Natalie Wood.
Really, he was not a rebel in the sense that he was not rejecting parents. He wasn't sort of saying, leave me alone. I don't want to have anything to do with you. I'm going to do my own thing. He was really saying, listen to me, you know, hear me, love me. He was just trying to get that connection, you know, so much in Rebel, the scene where he was saying to his father, you know, he was trying to make the parents into people that he could love and into people that would help him.
I tried to get to know him. Started by saying hello, no answer. He wouldn't talk to people on the set. He would be into himself, into his thing. He'd lock himself up into his dressing room. Finally, about halfway through the picture in the Chickie Run, it was at night, I grabbed him and literally threw him into a car and said, look, I really want to be a great actor too, and I want to know what you're doing. I mean, I want to know what your secret is. And he said, why? And I said, because I want to be a great actor. He says, why do you want to be a great actor?
East of Eden and Rebel Without a Cause were released in 1955, the same year that another groundbreaking movie altered the way teenagers viewed the world.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock.
Blackboard Jungle was the first movie to include a rock and roll soundtrack. Bill Haley's Rock Around the Clock became a hit. Rock historian Martin Lewis.
Technological advances, particularly in television and radio, meant that new trends spread across the country faster than in previous generations. And for the first time, teenagers were creating their own style. The movie Blackboard Jungle and the song Rock Around the Clock, which both became hits, with Bill Haley becoming the first rock and roll superstar. Meanwhile, word was starting to spread from Memphis about a young guy called Elvis Presley, whose shocking music was exciting a whole new generation. Then, Rebel Without a Cause was released in October of that year, and the kids suddenly had a visual connection to the rebellious music they were hearing on the radio. And the world would never be the same again.
Martin Landau.
Prior to World War II, grown-ups determined style, music, and most culture in this country. After World War II, it changed. There was a lot of unrest and dissatisfaction with the status quo. Times were changing, communication. Things started happening quicker and there were more awarenesses. Tastes started changing and the young people began to sow their oats and express themselves. That's when rhythm and blues started and rock and roll started and black music suddenly became white music and barriers started changing. And you had a lot of dissatisfaction with a lot of teenagers who felt cramped in this expanding world. And Jimmy and Elvis were rebels with a cause, without a cause, with reason, without reason.
James Dean's role of Jim Stark in Rebel Without a Cause hit a chord with teenagers all over the world. On this side of the Atlantic, for the first time, kids saw images of U.S. teenagers who were part of the generation that were embracing the exciting new sounds of rock and roll. Bill Wyman explains.
Being a bit of a rebel, like everybody wanted to be, I could relate to him, and I suppose many teenagers at the time could relate to him, because they weren't always happy with their parents, and they wanted a fast car, and they wanted to be cool and all that, you know, and you just dared to do things, and I immediately went out and bought a guitar. You were so inspired, because everything was changing in America. Brando, you know, Dean, Elvis, the whole thing was just like it was in England in the 60s. We were 6 or 8 years later, but it was the same thing. Fashion, design, art, music, theatre, films changed in England.
Adam Faith.
He represented for the first time on the screen someone of our age group that was going his own way. He didn't necessarily succeed at it, but who cared? He was going his own way. And up to then, really, teenagers weren't encouraged to learn by their own mistakes. They were taught to learn by their betters, by their elders' mistakes, by their experience. And here was James Dean experiencing life totally for himself.
George Perry.
Until James Dean came along, teenagers were very repressed species. The idea of the t-shirts and the jeans and all that stuff, Jimmy Dean was going around, you know, in his cowboy boots and his t-shirts and the zipper jackets and so on. Long before that was the norm. And in fact, if you were to plunk him down in the street today, he'd look perfectly in place. In the 50s, he looked unusual.
David Bailey was a young photographer when he first saw Rebel Without a Cause.
He was the first young American hero in a way, because he was a teenager, and they didn't have teenagers, it seemed to me, in America. He wasn't cheesy like Frank Sinatra, he wasn't really cool, he was just like a nouveau riche gangster, wasn't he? Whereas James Dean was sort of cool. Sometimes when I photograph a young actor, I say, give us a bit of the James Dean moody, and they seem to know what it is. There's a kind of James Dean code. The first big money I ever got, I went out and bought a black leather jacket.
You should have seen us run when we heard the last school bell ring.
David Putnam was also inspired by James Dean's jacket.
I lived in a suburb, North London, and one day I was walking past a men's shop, Meekers, and in the window was this red anorak. And I went in and found one that fitted me, and my friend Derek bought one as well, and we were able to walk around for a couple of years, going come up to Soho to the coffee bars, wearing this extraordinary red jacket, which was a replica of James Dean's, until it literally fell off our backs. But the fact that this odd men's store in Southgate, North London, actually had this jacket in it is some testament to the influence that James Dean must have had even then.
No more lies.
Michael J. Sheridan.
He affected people worldwide. Whatever the genius was within him, he did something. He tripped something in all of us that made us stand up and look and see what the hell was going on with him. Prior to James Dean, I don't think the teenagers had an identity.
Go, man, go, we got 3 months to kill.
Elvis Presley was one of the American teenagers who became obsessed with James Dean and decided that he too wanted to become an actor. When Elvis met Rebel Without a Cause director Nicholas Ray, he knelt down on his knees and began to recite pages of Dean's dialogue and told the director he had watched the movie dozens of times to learn the lines. Presley's career took off virtually at the same time as James Dean's. Yet despite all the influence Dean had on rock and roll stars, he died before Elvis had released his first hit. But his on-screen image matched perfectly the power of rock and roll. Bill Wyman.
Elvis's rebellion and ours did it via music, whereas Brando and James Dean were doing it on the big screen. When I first saw him in those films, he really did blow my mind. Like Elvis did when I first heard the first Elvis record, the ears go back on the back of your neck, and you know that it's something exceptionally special and original.
door, that door. So I pack all around the world. He's me away, he won't know what to
do. Bob Dylan was another young musician who idolized James Dean. Leroy Hoikala was a school friend of Bob's and played in his first band, the Golden Chords.
John Buckland, Bob Dylan, Bob Zimmerman at the time, and myself, our idol was James Dean, no doubt about it. We figured that not only a great, great actor, we figured that it was a part of his personality that came out. And I still remember the movies we saw and everything. We saw them about five times each, and I think Bob saw more than that. It was something brand new at the time because the old movies were not like Rebel Without a Cause, and that was one of our favorites. And Bob just loved that movie because he was a bit of a rebel himself. He was our idol. We had motorcycles at the time, and the three of us were basically a little nonconformist that we didn't go with the flow of everything. And to see someone like that acting, we decided it was absolutely great.
In Europe, teenagers influenced by the rebellious image of James Dean and the power of rock and roll were inspired to rebel in their own way. The Beatles were a group of young guys who took on Dean's persona and made it their own. Astrid Kircher was the band's photographer in the early days in Hamburg and was engaged to Stuart Sutcliffe. Once Dean had finished work on Rebel Without a Cause, he entered several more road races before he started filming Giant with Rock Hudson and Elizabeth Taylor. Dean played another rebellious character, the surly ranch hand Jet Rink, who strikes it rich and becomes a corporate giant. Romantic death is built into the James Dean myth. He lived fast and died young. It's death that keeps him alive.